Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome and thanks for joining us on If You Love This Planet. My special guest today is Mary Olson, Southeast Regional Coordinator for the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, NIRS. For 30 years, NIRS has been the National Information and Networking Centre for citizens concerned about nuclear power, radioactive waste, radiation and sustainable energy issues. Based in Asheville, North Carolina, Mary Olson joined the NIRS staff in 1991 because the nuclear industry was planning to deregulate about one-third of the nation's radioactive waste, dump it in ordinary landfills, and recycle it into building materials and consumer products with no labeling. She was then asked by Native American activists to help stop the dumping of high-level radioactive waste on Indian reservations, and was recruited to head the Stop Mobile Chernobyl campaign that woke up communities across the US to the danger of shipping carcinogenic waste on roads and through towns. Mary Olson has spoken at the United Nations three times on nuclear power and climate, and she joins me now. Welcome, dear Mary.
So lovely to be with you, Helen.
I first really came in contact with you when I was revising my book, Nuclear Madness, I think in the mid-90s, and I kept sending stuff to NIRS asking for the NIRS staff to check it, and no one took it up, but you did, didn't you?
Well, I was a new hire, and I couldn't believe that your faxes were low on the list. They were very high on my list because I'm a radiation victim, Helen. I got cooked at work years before I joined the NIRS staff. It was a research lab, but my health was in jeopardy. And it was your book, Nuclear Madness, in its first edition, that really helped me get sane and find help in contextualizing what had happened to me and figuring out how to restore my health, and eventually led to my becoming an activist on these issues.
And oh, so really? I didn't know that.
Nuclear Madness was a tremendously important document to me. So the idea that I could help expand and update it was a top priority, not just another thing on the list, the way, you know, you get overwhelmed when you work in a national office. Nothing against my coworkers. They just had very long lists of things to do.
Well, it was wonderful, Mary. Tell me how you got cooked. What happened? What were you doing? What lab were you working in?
I was a young hire research assistant in the Yale Medical School.
How old?
24 years old.
Yep.
And was working with both tritium and phosphorus 32. Decided I didn't want to work with the phosphorus 32. Did not realize that one of the objects in the lab was very highly contaminated. Not, you know, picocuries or millicuries, but actually had, you know, 1,000 times more, much more than labs typically have.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, one of these objects was not labeled and was not verbally, no verbal warning was given to me, and I handled it with no protection at all for about a week.
What sort of object?
Just two little Petri dishes that were glued together. I could have done it easily enough with two new Petri dishes, probably about 15 cents worth of cost, but a graduate student, I don't think maliciously, I think just carelessly, said, oh, here, use these, but didn't tell me that she had used phosphorus 32 just a day or so before in very, very high concentration.
So how did you find out? How did you discover?
Well, that was the accident. I was worried about all this. I was the new hire. I'd been in the lab 2 weeks. I wanted to use a Geiger counter to keep track of all of what was going on. Of course, the tritium couldn't be picked up with it. I started noticing hot spots in the lab that were originating from me having contaminated hands and handling things. And I told my boss that the Geiger counter was picking up hot spots. I didn't know where they were coming from. He dismissed it, said, oh, the Geiger counter wasn't working right. I said, well, then get one that does work. And he had some money he had to spend, so he said, sure, I'll get a new one, and he did, and was trying to convince me that it was my tritium and that that could, you know, the Geiger counter could pick it up. No, the Geiger counter cannot pick up tritium, and the stock bottle read zero, but all my tools read off the scale, literally off the scale of the Geiger counter, incredibly high levels of phosphorus 32, which is a, you know, it's a beta emitter, et cetera, et cetera. But I clearly got an internal exposure because things at home were reading when I took the Geiger counter home.
Oh, were they?
Toothbrush and pillow and glasses and, you know, a lot of personal items.
Really?
So, you know, it's all very scary. Very, very scary. And so your book directed me to Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I called, and in Boston they said, you know, talk to somebody in nuclear medicine, and they helped me contextualize what the level of dose I had maybe gotten. Hard to reconstruct the whole thing, because first thing I did when I discovered it was that dish was put it in the radioactive waste container, you know. It was a little chute that went down from the...
From the
hood in the lab.
Yeah.
And so I destroyed the evidence myself very quickly. Not that it turned into a criminal case at all, but just that I couldn't really reconstruct it all from that point. So anyway, it impacted me greatly. I had a lot of health consequences. I never did go to court, so I didn't have to prove that they were associated with that event. But I certainly had never had asthma in my life. I became chemically intolerant, like so many people who have environmental illness. I had those types of symptoms. I lost my menstrual cycle at that age. I had a metabolic disorder up here that's genetically based, that runs in my family, but not typically to older. I had, you know, really fairly major consequences from this thing.
Oh, well... I you know, I used to work at Harvard, and they were pretty cavalier about their radioactive stuff. They used to store it in the fridge next to their sandwiches and the like. So
yeah,
and I think at one stage the lab was so heavily contaminated, the government authority shut it down, and that was Harvard. And also when they worked with I-131, you know, potent carcinogen, they just used to let it go up out of the chimneys into the atmosphere, and that was at the Children's Hospital Medical Center.
Indeed. And I do believe that our leadership in our society comes through these institutions, and the attitudes that people demonstrate towards radioactivity in those institutions, as you said, are cavalier. They're irresponsible, in my view. I was a 24-year-old hire. I was dependent on these people to train me well
and look
and
after
have
you.
Good practices and look after me, and instead I ended up a victim. And I believe that these people are trendsetters in our society's viewpoint on things. And so an awful lot of people don't take radioactivity and radiation seriously as a threat because so many of these academics are acting like it's no big deal.
Yes, and then, you know, some of them get cancer later in life. I wonder if any of them then go back through the retrospectoscope and reconsider what could have caused it.
I have no idea, but I do consider this a little bit of unfinished business in my life. Eventually, I may have to do some time educating in that sector, but in the organization that I work for, Nuclear Information and Resource Service, I landed up here in the energy sector. I couldn't really understand why. My primary concern is radiation and health. Come to find out, Helen, I didn't know this before I got this job, 95% of the radioactivity that is a danger to our planet that comes from industrial activities, including the nuclear weapons production, all of it taken together, over 95% of the radioactivity comes from making electricity. I had no idea that the mother load of this stuff that I ran into a teeny tiny bit of in that lab, you know, that the vast amount of it comes from making electric power. And so we just haven't wanted to pick a big fight with either the medical or research community because they really are dealing with teeny, teeny, tiny amounts compared to turning
on the light switch. It was 95% because I know the military's made huge amounts of high-level radioactive waste. But
well, the volume is a little bit slightly different.
Oh, I don't want to talk about volume. It's activity,
It's activity, and 95% of it. You just think about it. It's like they put off the equivalent of 6 bombs worth of heat a day. And so, you know, each reactor is equivalent to detonating 6 atomic bombs a day in radioactivity as well. And they've been running, some of them now, for 4 decades. And it's that kind of continuous around-the-clock activity that's just making vast, huge amounts of radioactivity.
Yes, and also the heat is obviously now adding to global warming.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
6 bombs a day worth of heat.
Right. And quite frankly, a lot of folks don't understand that plutonium, and when, you know, a lot of people don't understand, you don't go out and dig up plutonium. Plutonium occurs in just teeny tiny traces inside uranium deposits sometimes, but the tonnage quantities are all made inside reactors. And I was looking at the figures today, and it's like 200 pounds of military plutonium has been made worldwide. These are like 1995 numbers. So in the military side, they're probably inched up a little bit, but not much. But as of 1995, there was over 1,000 tons of plutonium in the waste from reactors.
Now, wait a minute. You said 200 pounds made in the military.
I'm sorry. I meant tons. 200 tons of military and 1,000 tons in the commercial side. It's not all been separated. We don't want it separated, which is part of what we're going to talk about today. But the fact is it's a vast amount, not only of radioactivity, but of this very problematic element.
All right. So talk about the medical toxicity of plutonium and how long it survives in the environment, Mary.
Well, the primary plutonium that we worry about is plutonium-239, and it has a half-life, meaning how long it takes in time for half of it to morph. You know, Hollywood didn't invent morphing. Morphing happens at the atomic level in these unstable elements. That's what radioactivity is the process of going towards stability in this sort of morphing process. So in 24,000 years, half of a given amount of plutonium will have morphed into something else. So the half-life of plutonium is 24,000 years, which puts you up with 10 half-lives for the hazardous period, down to where you're into relatively small quantities. It's like, you know, 250,000 years for this material to subside away. So it's virtually forever. Not a transient thing that we have done. It's dangerous now, and it will be dangerous for that long. And toxicity, well, you can take the number of cancers that would come out of a major reactor accident like Chernobyl. There's arguments. Is it 5,000? Is it 500,000 latent cancers over time? One of our visionary scientists in the nuclear age, Dr. John Goffman, says no, it's more like 3 to 5 million. Fatal cancers from the Chernobyl accident. Few used plutonium in the Chernobyl reactor instead of uranium. You double the numbers. So, you know, the industry people are saying, well, 5,000 fatal cancers from Chernobyl, double it. John Goffman is saying 3 to 5 million.
Double it.
Double it.
And it's probably a microgram. A millionth of a gram is almost certainly carcinogenic.
Yes. And I believe that you said that 1 pound, if evenly distributed, could cause lung cancer in every man, woman, and child on the planet. But that was long enough ago that we have to now say 2 pounds since the population has nearly doubled.
God. And the other relevant thing is that they did a lot of experiments with plutonium in the early days of bomb making because they were scared stiff of the stuff. And when they injected it into beagle dogs, they didn't find a dose low enough that didn't give all the dogs cancer. And that was 10 to the minus 9 grams or picogram quantities.
Indeed. And we do know that plutonium has been dispersed in our environment. And so anyone who wonders why we're having cancer epidemics, I'm not going to say all the cancer is caused by plutonium in our environment or by other forms of radioactivity, but try to prove that it's not some of it caused by that.
Yep.
You can't prove it either way, and we do know that it has been dispersed through the atmospheric weapons test that got you going in the first place, being an activist on these issues, and certainly was a deep, grave concern for so many people. So,
and it has a predilection for testicles, and every male in the Northern Hemisphere has a tiny load of plutonium in his testicle from the fallout, and testicular cancer is increasing.
It is. And I think it's important to note that these elements, these heavy metals, concentrate in all seeds of every kind. And that jeopardizes all types of reproduction in the world. I mean, the crops that we depend on for our food, the beings, little critters that we depend on for pollinating our food, the entire chain of life is in jeopardy because all of those seeds, eggs, sperm, gonads are where these types of materials concentrate.
Yeah. Okay, now, so let's move on to how they want to use plutonium now in the United States. What are the new plans, Mary Olson?
Well, there's an interesting thing going on in the United States right now. I kind of think it's like a magician who is trying to distract the audience while he or she does something else. The dove flies around and the beautiful silk scarves wave, and there's kind of this big illusion that the magician creates so that everybody doesn't notice what's really going on at the same time. And this is what's going on with the promotion of what they're calling Generation 4, or GEN, and then the Roman numeral 4, looks like an IV. And I'm going to come back to that image of it being an IV, but just to finish the story, right now we have the first proposed nuclear power reactors in over 30 years in the United States. The industry was completely on hold. Many people thought it was completely dead. And because of that, a lot of folks were not really paying attention that much as the industry came back around. They are proposing to build not these Generation 4 reactors right now, but really the same old type of reactor that there's 433 at the moment. I may have that number a little bit low. 442, okay, in the world today, operable. Many of them do not operate on a daily basis because of all the problems, so we call them operable. But they're basically just planning to expand the same technology. So on top of that first move to go into what we're calling nuclear relapse, because this industry should be on hold. It should be dead. It's not competitive in the energy market. It's not safe. It's not secure. And it certainly doesn't solve the global warming problem. So since they have this failed technology that they're trying to pursue again, they're putting up this billboard, this sort of, again, the image of the scarf and the dove, the distraction of these supposedly perfect reactors, these perfect reactors that won't need uranium to be dug out of the ground on indigenous lands because they'll run on plutonium that will have been made from all of these other reactors, that big supply of 200 tons that I mentioned, and even more that will be generated by the new ones they want to build. And so, you know, they're forecasting this future, this Generation 4 that's going to be perfect and wonderful and too cheap to meter. Meanwhile, they're expanding the ones that are too expensive to matter, too expensive for investors to be willing to touch with a 10-foot pole, that they're trying to get full, complete public funding for, whether it's reaching into the ratepayers' pockets ahead with the construction work in progress plans where they can prepay the power plants out of people's utility bills, or whether it's reaching into the taxpayers' pocket by doing federal loan guarantees, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, they're kind of like covering over this really sort of decrepit situation that is not good. I mean, there's really no positive selling point for this idea of reviving nuclear power with this complete fantasy.
So just to summarize, Mary, and I'm interviewing Mary Olson, who works for the Southeast Regional Area of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. There are 104 operating nuclear power plants in America. Many of them are reaching their sort of use-by date. They have to then be replaced if they want to keep going with new nuclear power plants, and that over, you know, a couple of decades would be 104. And they're not any safer than the old ones. They're the same design, same flaws, same problems. So when they say they're safer, that's a lie. And then they're talking about a new sort of reactor, which is called Generation 4 reactors. So I want you to walk through what a Generation 4 reactor is so people really understand.
Yes. So these, I just want to be clear, these are fantasies. They don't exist today. And the first fantasy is that a breeder reactor, and this is, they've dropped the word breeder, they're calling them integral fast reactors, or IFRs. But those are basically the same technology as has been tried 12 times worldwide, many different places, France, Japan, United States, 12 times has been tried, and 12 times they have failed. So this technology has a zero batting average, and yet it's being promoted as the solution. And the reason it's being promoted as the solution, Ellen, you know the word nuke speak. Nuke speak is like, we would call it a lie, except for it's kind of cuter to call it nuke speak, but it's where the industry takes words and redefines them to mean something like, usually opposite of what most people think it means.
Propaganda.
So, like, breeders have this nuke speak, this propaganda that they burn up nuclear waste. And most normal people hearing the words burn up nuclear waste would think that means get rid of nuclear waste. Don't you? I mean, isn't that? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but it turns out that burn up is a technical term. And it means reducing the amount of plutonium and uranium that can be split, the type that will fission, and any other fissionable element that might be forming in there. Burning up means to reduce the percentage of those things. So right now, we have all this plutonium in the waste from the current reactors. If it were high burn up, it would have less plutonium in it. But the trick is, it would then have even more radioactivity, even more what's called curies, which is how many counts per minute, how hot is it with your Geiger counter, how much cancer can it cause? High burn-up is very much more carcinogenic because it has that much more energetic particles and waves coming off of it. So it's the opposite. Instead of having terrible nuclear waste, we have nuclear waste that's like two to three times more
God,
terrible.
Awful nuclear waste. And what happens is when plutonium fissions, you get the fission products, strontium-90, cesium-137, radioactive iodine, tritium, the whole thing.
Right.
And they only last 600 years, and they say, well, you know, we're getting rid of radioactive waste instead of lasting quarter of a million years, it only lasts 600 years, and there are three generations of humans per 100 years. So we're talking about 18 generations who have to deal with this stuff.
Right. So if Columbus had had radioactive waste, we would, you know, still be having to be concerned about its hazard. I'm talking about Christopher Columbus, as in, you know, 600 years ago.
Yeah.
And so I ask people when I go to their communities, do you know where the grindstone for this community was? Because that's about, you know, 100 years ago, that grindstone was central.
Mm.
And people generally don't even know where the grindstone was, let alone something sort of marginal and scary and nobody really knows very much about it, like nuclear waste.
Yeah, so that's a legacy we leave to our successive generations. So, okay, so why are they called breeders? You've got to explain how you put rods full of plutonium into a reactor instead of uranium, 5 to 15 tons of it, and then how is it cooled? What are the dangers of the coolant that they use? Could it explode and reach critical mass? And how do you, what does breeding mean?
Okay, let's take it one step at a time. These are very high temperature operations. They can't be cooled the way reactors that are all over the United States and Europe are cooled with liquid that's basically water. And that will only go to a certain temperature and then it won't work anymore. And so these reactors are designed to be cooled with liquid metal, specifically sodium has been used. Now, the problem is that sodium on contact with air is immediately combustible, and most of the breeder programs around the world have gone down to catastrophic fires. In the case of the Manju reactor in Japan, they brought it online. It operated less than a year before sodium leaks started a series of fires that were so catastrophic that that facility continues to be offline. They keep forecasting when it will come back, but it was catastrophic. It's not recoverable. In the United States, the Fermi 1 reactor, there's a great book called We Almost Lost Detroit about the meltdown of that reactor. Now, in terms of the explosiveness, well, there's these fires, yes, but there's always the possibility in a reactor of going supercritical.
What does that mean?
Supercritical means that instead of being a reactor where one splitting of an atom is supposed to lead to one other splitting of an atom, so it's a moderated activity, like what I call it is a nuclear bomb with a clutch in, so that, you know, one split leads to one split leads to one split. That's called steady state, and you can ramp it down, you ramp it up for more or less power to take it offline. If you go supercritical, that condition is over. The clutch is out, is gone, and you have that, you know, geometric expansion in the number of splits. And yes, you can have a nuclear explosion in a reactor. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission of the United States calls it rapid core disassembly, if that were to occur.
Rapid core
disassembly. So if you see rapid core disassembly being mentioned in a discussion, you can pretty well know they mean a reactor that lost its steady state and a supercriticality happened.
And it exploded with a massive nuclear explosion because plutonium is used for the fuel for nuclear weapons for obvious reasons. So if you've got 5 to 15 tons of plutonium and there's a nuclear explosion in it, that material is scattered to the four winds, right, Mary?
Yes, absolutely.
For Christ's sake.
That's an interesting point, too, Helen. They say that in the United States that we have containment and therefore Chernobyl can't happen.
Yeah.
Well, there was a long, elaborate discussion about whether the explosion at Chernobyl was chemical, meaning some form of combustion, or was it nuclear? Because a nuclear explosion cannot be contained.
Yep.
You may have containment, but it simply causes the energy to build up to the point where it can break out of that containment.
Of course.
And so in the United States, where we have very often two units, now they're proposing to expand current sites to three and four units. If you had a nuclear explosion inside of U.S. containment, it would get so big that it would take out all those units.
All
together.
The other reactors as well.
And so, you know, they say that if there had been U.S.-style containment at Chernobyl, if it was, I still don't know how it sorted out. There's a lot of propaganda on both sides. But if it was a nuclear explosion at Chernobyl that caused that terrible destruction that happened that night in April of 1986, then it would have taken out the additional units that were right there. So I don't think we should be crowing about containment as a panacea. Now, I do want to go back to your question about breeding and start with how is plutonium formed in our current reactors? I said it's in the waste and it's about 1% of the waste.
Yeah.
Well, when we put fuel in a light water reactor, the kind we have now, it's pure uranium.
Yeah.
It's two types of pure uranium, but it's pure uranium. And so the fact that other stuff accumulates in there is the fact that when an atom breaks, it leaves little crumbly pieces, and those little crumbly pieces are other elements, cesium, strontium, iodine, all those. But in addition to the breaking going on, there's a second process, and that process is the type of uranium that doesn't split under those conditions, and that's called U-238. And U-238 has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. It's relatively stable compared to other things. It's got such a long half-life that we as a planet have only just passed the first half-life of U-238 or about to pass it as a planet because, you know, that's about the age of the Earth. So it sits in there. It doesn't split. But when it's hit by a fast-moving particle called a neutron that's coming out of the other type of uranium that is splitting, these neutrons are just blowing out. Well, if it hits dead on, that neutron can be absorbed. And that U-238, through a little bump up to Neptunium-239 and a little quick decay step, pretty much instantaneously goes from being uranium to morphing, that sort of weird, amazing transition, from uranium into plutonium. And the dominant plutonium that is formed is plutonium-239, which is the one with the 24,000-year half-life that bomb makers just absolutely adore. They think it's the cat's meow. So there it is. Your uranium is generating plutonium during the fission in a regular power, the ones we have now. Light water reactors are making plutonium. So if you have a breeder reactor that actually works, and I want to point out again, there's not a single breeder reactor on Earth that is working, and the 12 attempts have been miserable failures. So this is a fantasy we're talking about. But if your fantasy were to succeed, you'd load in your plutonium fuel, and then you'd pack what's called a blanket around it of your uranium-238. And as the plutonium fissions and these neutrons come bamming out of them, just flying out with all this energy, and they hit that uranium, some of that uranium is going to morph and transition into more plutonium. So it's called a breeder because while it's using plutonium fuel, it's making more plutonium fuel.
Yeah, so you get more plutonium out than you put in. And the other point to note is, you know, when they say they're burning the fuel and you think it's disappearing, burning plutonium, actually only 10% of it fissions into other products like cesium and strontium, 90% still remains in the reactor. So it's a fabric of lies.
It is. It's voodoo economics. And the reason I call it economics is they actually talk about the neutron economy inside the core. And it's a good thing they talk about it because you got to manage those neutrons. If you don't, you have, as you've pointed out, a thermonuclear event instead of a power plant. And that, you know, I just want to cut into a little bird's eye view of the trade-off. These technologies cost as much as retail solar panels being installed on people's roofs. Retail solar panels may not work at night. It may be a more complicated discussion about how to provide the equivalent of baseload power. But for the same price, you can get retail solar that doesn't have thermonuclear explosion as a possibility, doesn't have any waste, doesn't have any fuel costs, doesn't require water. We need to talk about water, but doesn't require water for cooling, doesn't require complex security regimes or non-proliferation treaties or any of that. And they're in the same cost arena.
How do you mean? For one breeder, how many houses can be covered with solar panels?
Well, right now, I'm going to set aside the breeder cost question because nobody knows how much they're going to cost because they're failures. They're fantasies. They're part of the magician's wand, you know?
Yeah.
But the real cost of the existing reactors that they want to build now, the more light water reactors, is in the order of $8,000 to $10,000 per installed kilowatt. And we have solar panels that are in the $1,000 to $3,000 range. We have wind that is definitely in the $2,000 and $3,000 range. So, you know, nuclear is actually more expensive than these options by a large enough factor that you could say, okay, install twice of what you need and store the power, and we're into the ballpark of baseload. So all I'm saying is that this is pure nuke speak to bring up, and I now want to go back to this Gen 4, you know, G-E-N, and then the Roman numeral with the I and the V. That is what it is. They're trying to say, take the oil IV, the addictive oil thing, out of one elbow, and stick this fantasy nuclear IV into the other elbow.
Oh, that's a nice analogy, Mary.
And you don't have to change any of your lifestyle. You don't have to worry about efficiency. And you sure as hell don't have to take money out of the pockets of your buddies who got you into office.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, the renewable business people, maybe they'll get to the point that they're able to bankroll Congress and bankroll state legislators, but they're still struggling to come online. And it's the big utility corporations in the United States, the big energy companies, and in Europe too, I'm sure in Japan as well, that are, you know, these guys who own coal, they own nuclear. They certainly don't want to reduce consumption through efficiency because that would shoot themselves in the foot, because less power means less money in the current equations. And they sure as hell don't really want to see solar as the answer because they've got all these existing investments in relationships.
And they can't own the sun. Someone said if they could have put a blanket around the earth and sold holes in it, they would have been into solar power years ago.
I agree with you. I'm really hoping, though, that there's a little opportunity to educate these guys that it's a fusion reactor sitting 93 million miles away.
Yep.
You know? So if you like nuclear, totally embrace this option.
Totally.
Because, you know, it's a safe distance. You don't have to worry about the terrorists or anything, you know?
Yeah. Now, talk about, you live in the Southeast, and what part of Carolina?
I live in Western North Carolina in the mountains.
Yeah. Tell us about what's happening down there in terms of the nuclear industry.
Oh, well, right now there's 26 pending license applications. I'm
26?
Not talking about, you know, what's reported in the press in terms of new reactors. I'm talking about actual license applications at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, 26 new units that corporations are seeking. Of those 26, 23 are in the South, if you count Texas as the South. And
right.
I do, but some people call it the Republic of Texas. It's got 8. So if you take them off, there's still 15 that are in the southern states. And the reason for this, not only is I think there are some cultural issues, but the main reason is that the South never deregulated our utility markets. You still have only one provider. You know, they deregulated long distance. Now you can pick who provides your long-distance service in the United States. And in many parts of the country, you can also pick who is your power provider. But in the southeastern block of states, from really Virginia all the way across, it's still regulated. And the state, gives territory to different corporations. The state sets the rates, and the corporations then agree to supply power for the people in those service areas. And because of that, we're hostages. And if the corporation convinces the state that they got to have a new reactor, historically, sometimes in like Georgia in the 1980s, power bills tripled overnight thanks to the cost of nuclear power.
Oh, dear. And that's what is about to happen, right?
Yes.
And they're already charging ratepayers a lot to prospectively to build their new nuclear power.
Florida, South Carolina, and North Carolina have something called construction work in progress. And in Florida, the bills in one of the service areas have gone up 23% already. And that's just for early, you know.
At a time when America's suffering really a depression.
We're calling it a middle class tax because this isn't related to energy consumption at all. It
No.
is purely a tax. It's transferring the risk from the shareholders of the corporation to the customers. And it's completely unfair because the customers get no additional benefit. This program does not reduce the possibility that the thing might be canceled before it ever goes online. It doesn't reduce any costs at all. It's simply a transference of risk.
And also people who live near the reactor are at risk of getting cancer because of the continuous outflow of radioactive gases and water and stuff from the reactor.
Helen, I have to stop you there because I think the next few years of my life are going to be quite different. I've been sort of dodging this issue of the local communities, and I really hang my head to say I think the whole anti-nuclear movement in the United States to some degree has dodged the issues of the local communities. But we've had a 20-year-old activists step up and go door to door in a South Carolina town that has a nuclear power plant. And she reports that every single house has cancer. Now,
what?
This is anecdotal. This is not a scientifically based thing. This is a 20-year-old going door to door and talking to people on a listening project, listening to them about their concerns.
What reactor are they near?
Summer, which is run by South Carolina Gas
Electric. Is it a 1,000 megawatt?
Yes, it's 1,000.
How
megawatts.
Close are they, these people, within a
20-mile
radius?
It's very close. It's a town on the same lake
God.
That the reactor's on.
Yes, and of course the reactor uses 1 million gallons of water a minute from the lake, and that water is contaminated with tritium and all sorts of other stuff.
Yes.
Do they use that water to drink?
This question I don't know the answer to, but I'm understanding that my near-term priorities and objectives need to change, and I believe the fact of the matter is that latency periods are up. And these reactors went online long enough ago that it's not prospective cancer sometime down the line. Hello, hello, it is cancer here and now.
We can't prove that it's the power plant, but
you prove that it's not.
Yeah. Takes 5 to 60 years to get cancer once you've been exposed to radiation, if you're going to. Mary, what are the main companies wanting to build these reactors? Areva, I know, is one, and that's from France.
Well, that's a reactor supplier, but they're also getting into the business of buying up reactor sites. The Calvert Cliffs proposal, closest one to Washington, D.C., the fiscal soundness of that utility was getting to be wobbly, in part because they made a nice little shell corporation with no assets to build the reactor and protected it from the parent company by about 6 layers. But it was, you know, not clear that the corporation was going to proceed with this project that Areva would build. So Areva is now attempting to purchase the utility in the United States. So one of the things we're challenging is the whole issue of foreign ownership, which, you know, you're not supposed to have foreign countries owning what could be a nuclear bomb next to your capital city. Anyway, so Areva, yes. There's, of course, GE, which is now Hitachi, and Westinghouse, which is now Toshiba. My young activists say they can't even build laptops. What are they doing building reactors? And then, of course, in the power company side, we have TVA, the biggest public utility in the country, Tennessee Valley Authority. We have Southern Company all across Georgia and Alabama. We have Duke Energy in the Carolinas. We have Dominion in Virginia. And in good old Florida, you know, they need to fight climate change in Florida since most of the state is only about 3 feet above sea level. They do need to fight climate change there, but unfortunately they're choosing nuclear as their means rather than vast reduction in consumption through efficiency and then using all that wonderful Florida sunshine for solar potential. So down there it's Florida Power Light, and then also Progress Energy, which is both in Florida and in North Carolina.
Okay, so how are we going to stop this, Mary?
Well, they need to have public funding. They need to have federal loan guarantees, and they need to have this construction work in progress where they can get prepayment from their customers.
Right, pays. Yep.
So we've got to stop those two things, and that's basically an opinion battle. At the federal level, we have a new array of players at both the executive branch and in Congress. The U.S. Senate, however, does not look all that wonderful, I have to say. I think we're going to have trouble there, so that's going to take some work, and I hope that people who are paying attention will look at who's coming up for re-election and try and run a good slate of staunch folks who understand that it is possible. And I want to just now mention carbon-free, nuclear-free, because this is a book that was written by Dr. Arjun Makajani with support of Dr. Helen Caldicott and many other people. That lays out a roadmap for the fact that we don't need nuclear to meet the climate goals. And we can phase out carbon emissions on the timeline if we follow an integrated roadmap, which is laid out in the book Carbon Free, Nuclear Free. So really calling on everyone to take this seriously and to find candidates who will back this project, because it's our future. You know, as a young coordinator said this morning, We're on the brink of this marvelous new world where we are living in balance and we're working together and being so much more gentle with our planet, or we're on the brink of, you know, ongoing disaster and one crisis after another, and pretty much business as we have known it is over either way, either because we become sustainable or because we choose to ignore the crisis and let it grow.
Well, now you've just been today, Mary Olson, at the Carbon Free Nuclear Free Conference. How many people are there? And tell us the sort of energy, that's a bad analogy, but the energy that was amongst the people there, and were they excited, and what came out of it?
Well, we had about 70 people from around the United States, a nice array of ages, a little bit of diversity in terms of ethnicity, but the room was full of people who are veteran, long-term, been committed to stopping nuclear energy in the United States, and are finally thrilled, absolutely thrilled, to have something we can be for.
Yeah.
And what we are all for is a sustainable future. And for a long time there was sort of this gray zone, because we were all getting very concerned about the climate crisis. We really felt that we could meet it with renewables, but there were doubting Thomases, there was insecurity, and we didn't have a technical basis for our argument.
Yeah.
And what this book has provided us is a very strong, number-crunched, laid out scenario that is technically feasible, that shows not only can we phase out to zero carbon emissions in terms of, ancient carbon, a little differentiation between, growing biofuels and using those, that's current carbon. So zero ancient carbon emissions and phase out, not overnight shut down, but phase out the reactors we have, don't build a single new one, and the astounding finding that quite shocked the researcher, Dr. Makajani, he did not expect this, but taking such a route is actually cheaper.
Yep.
The feeling today was we have a long fight ahead of us, but we had a really major victory just recently, pulling $50 billion of federal loan guarantee commitment out of the Obama stimulus package. And so we kind of were riding that wave. And the other wave that we're riding is just how many people are really stepping up and engaging in the fight to challenge both coal and nuclear power plants.
Good. Well, there are two major players, as far as I can see, kind of in Washington. One is Ed Markey, Congressman Ed Markey, who's the new head of the House Energy Committee. And one is John Holdren, who I know, who is President Obama's new science advisor. Why don't you discuss Ed Markey and his policies and his influence first, and then discuss John Holdren, Mary Olson?
I will, and I'll just add, however, that Henry Waxman is the chair of the Energy Committee, and I'll just say the fact that Waxman went to bat and challenged John Dingell, who had that committee for decades, and got it, was as big a victory for this country, in my view, as Obama beating McCain.
Yes.
It's enormous, because Henry Waxman is very committed to efficiency, to renewables, to climate legislation, all of our points. And he has ready at his arm Ed Markey, who is the subcommittee chair on energy and water. And Ed has the longest commitment in Congress opposing nuclear power and working for sustainable alternatives. And he has a brilliant staff. And I can't imagine. I mean, it's like a dream team in the U.S. House right now.
Yes.
Literally. I mean, when I heard that happened, I was like on the phone just instantly.
Yeah.
And we also have Nancy Pelosi, who I really honestly believe is our ally in opposing nuclear energy, and has taken quite a bit of her leadership role in reversing these nuclear loan guarantees. So I feel like the House is where we will see a substantial basis for hope. And it's not terrible in the Senate, because we have Barbara Boxer and we have Harry Reid, but there's bad news over there. Jeff Bingaman took over from his colleague in New Mexico, and Jeff is also pro-nuclear, not maybe as much as his predecessor, but is certainly not going to be our friend. So on the executive side, John Holdren is a real puzzle. He's got an eclectic background. I'm sure he's a visionary. I'd probably enjoy having dinner with him.
He's highly intelligent.
Yeah, except for the fact that I'm really mad at him, Helen, And the reason I'm still really mad at him goes back to the late 1990s when the MOX, Mixed Oxide Fuel Program, was preferentially taken as the route to deal with plutonium left over from dismantled nuclear weapons. Okay, this is a slightly big turn in our conversation, but it was wonderful that in the 1990s we had a large number of nuclear warheads being taken apart. Hallelujah. Wonderful, wonderful. However, it created a large pile
of plutonium.
Plutonium that on both the Russian and U.S. side had to be dealt with in some way. I fault Clinton and Gore for not handling this at a diplomatic level higher than the Department of Energy and in Russia, Minatom. But they, you know, they should have done that. They should have set policy at a much higher level and, in my view, declared plutonium to be a waste. And that program was called immobilization because it was going to be mixed with highly radioactive waste that actually originated from the same process of purifying the plutonium, put them back together, and eventually bury them in the repository and declare them a waste. Instead, what happened was that John Holdren, who was on the faculty of Harvard University, apparently under his own initiative, started holding secret meetings in Cambridge, bringing Minatom officials, that's the equivalent of the DOE in Russia, to Harvard. Well, it wasn't on campus, it was off campus, and officials from the Department of Energy. And they had these sit-down sessions in which they strategized how to do the MOX program, how to sell it politically, and they broke the Federal Advisory Committee Act, FACA, because these were secret meetings. Those of us who were working on the same issues in allied organizations, friends of Holdren's, tried to get into these meetings, were refused and rebuffed. And as a result, the MOX program was rolled out and is still in place. We're still fighting the MOX factory in South Carolina.
I had no idea John did that.
He did that, and I'm still mad at him. So don't invite us both for dinner.
Does he support Generation 4 reactors?
He loves Generation 4 reactors. There's a new book called Prescription for the Planet by a guy named Tom Bleese. Tom is a writer. He has no credentials at all, and he cites Holdren every third page on Generation 4 reactors.
Well, what are we going to do about John Holdren?
Well, maybe we should have dinner with him. I don't know. This is a problem, and the biggest problem is he's influencing people like our incredible climate visionary, climate hero,
I know.
Jim Hansen.
I know. Jim Hansen's now for Gen 4 reactors. That really...
Jim is a sweet man, but he doesn't know about energy. He doesn't know about radiation and health.
Understand.
He's not a biologist. He's not a medical doctor. No. He has no basis for making a considered opinion on these technologies, and I'm quite angry at him, too. I mean, I like him very much. I'm not saying he's a bad man, but he has angered me because he has gone out onto a limb on which he has no support, no basis, and is talking through his hat.
It seems to me that we, if only we could raise $80,000, we could put a full-page ad in the New York Times talking about these policies of John Holdren and Hansen and exposing what they mean medically to this generation and future generations on the planet.
I think a full-page ad is a great place to start. Then we need some governors or attorneys generals or members of state legislatures, that level of people, to really get on board with carbon-free, nuclear-free. Then we have to, once we have the majority of people in the room, have one of those secret meeting things like Holdren did, and they call it the Keystone Center or the Aspen Institute or whatever. But we have to go in there with our legislation already in the bag and let these guys know that they better play our game. I mean, that's the way they've been doing it for years. So I guess that's what we have to do, or we have to figure out a new way.
Or
but
you
we
could
need
you
to
could
get
policy
people to agree that sustainability is the only solution, and that these Gen 4 breeder fantasies are an irresponsible waste of money when we don't have time. We don't have time, Helen. I mean, I really hear it in the youth that I'm working with. I work most of my time with 20-year-olds now.
Yeah.
They know we don't have time. We have to be reducing consumption through efficiency, through new technologies. We have to be doing that, and we have to be going to fuel-free, low-impact, current generation of sunlight technologies. And that's it. And this other stuff is just a distraction. It's just all about old boy networks. It's all about money, and it's lethal. It will kill us.
Old boy networks. What about going to, last question and thought I have, Mary, is what about going to the lovely Ed Markey?
Yes. We absolutely always must go to the lovely Ed Markey, and I believe to Nancy Pelosi. She's quite amazing.
And the lovely Henry Waxman.
And the lovely Henry Waxman. And again, for people who are tracking elections in 2 years, there will be Senate seats, there will be House, the entire House. We must get candidates who are committed to a sustainable future, and we must run them against these old boy network people. That's what we have to do.
Yep. So everyone needs to read Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free, a roadmap for Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free Future by 2050 for the U.S. You can download it at IEER.org. If you want to learn more about all of this other information, Mary Olson, what is the NEAR's website?
www.nirs.org. And I want to just add that the Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free book in entirety at no cost, no charge whatsoever, is posted on that other website, IEER.org.
Yeah. And I would offer my services, Mary. I'm coming to the United States in October. Anything you can organize, we could do together to meet with the Congress people, to go and talk to communities, I'll be there.
Wonderful. I will bring this to our Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free conference tomorrow. Wonderful news.
Okay. Thank you, Mary Olson. I just loved talking to you. You're a dear friend. A lovely...
Big hug to you. Big hug to you.
Lovely person, and thank you very much for that very edifying conversation.
Thank you, Helen.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Mary Olson, a longtime anti-nuclear activist and environmental campaigner. Mary is a Southeast Regional Coordinator for the Nuclear Information and Resource Services, which you can find on their website at www.nirs.org. Thank you for joining us for this fascinating and extremely important conversation, and we'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.